Children will not protect what they do not love. And how can children learn to love nature and the earth if they don't play outside? Today on Earth Day, Nature and Childhood. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, the average American boy or girl spends as little as 30 minutes in unstructured outdoor play every day. There has been a dramatic change in childhood over the last 30 years, but the evolution has been going on longer than that. This hour, we'll take the long view. I'll talk with Pamela Riney-Kerberg about her new book, The Nature of Childhood, An Environmental History of Growing Up in America Since 1865. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Many of us have fond memories of playing outside when we were kids, playing outside until mom or dad called us in for dinner, and then sometimes going back out and playing until the streetlights came on. Today, life is different, but it hasn't just been changing over the last 30 years. This hour, we're going back a little further. My guest, Pamela Riney-Kerberg, has explored the history of childhood in her new book, The Nature of Childhood, An Environmental History of Growing Up in America Since 1865. She's also a professor and chair of the history department at Iowa State University. Hello, Pam.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Now, I know that you have fond memories of spending time playing outside when you were a kid growing up in Denver, Colorado. Can you tell us a little bit about the environment that you like to spend time in?
It was a very interesting environment to grow up in as a child. I lived directly across the street from an irrigation ditch that's known as the Highline Canal. And that irrigation ditch snakes through the suburbs of Denver. And, you know, for a few days every year, it would be full of water going out to farmers on the eastern plains. But throughout most of the year, it was empty. And you could go down in there and play in the mud. You could go down there and use your imagination. You could observe any number of animals. It was an urban wild space, and it was a wonderful place to grow up.
You actually have a number of pictures from your childhood in the book of a giant salamander. You write about a frog, the largest frog you say you've ever seen even to date. So you and your brother, your friends, and all of the children in the neighborhood spent a lot of time down there, right?
Yes, we did. We were generally told to stay away from the canal when there was water in there. But when there wasn't, we were given more or less free rein to play as long as we were sensible. And my parents trusted us to be sensible. I'm not sure we always were, but there was no really serious damage done.
Now, what made you want to go back further? I mean, a lot of observations have been made about how life has changed so dramatically from when you were a kid and when I was a kid and life today. I quoted the statistic earlier that the average American boy or girl spends less than 30 minutes outside every day in unstructured play. That doesn't mean that that's the only time they spend outside, but actually just being outside and having fun and deciding what they want to do. That kind of play has become very scarce for children in Iowa and in this country. What made you want to go back further and look at that kind of play way back to the Civil War days?
I wrote another book several years back called Childhood on the Farm, and I looked at children's lives on farms in the Midwest from the 1870s up to 1920. And one of the issues that really concerned me was the way in which children interact with the world around them. And I was examining the world that my grandparents lived in. And it just intrigued me how much freedom children had in their limited spare time to do what they wanted in the out-of-doors, and that their parents paid very little attention to what they did. Mom and Dad were busy. Mom was usually in the house making dinner, sewing, taking care of, you know, many children. Fathers were often in the fields working. And kids really were expected to take care of themselves. And in those free times, they had very interesting interactions with the world around them.
Well, let's talk about those early rural experiences. And as I mentioned, you went back to 1865, but you really write about the latter part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century altogether, the experiences that farm kids, rural kids had with nature. And as you said, it wasn't all play. We kind of have this idyllic idea that they got to be out there under the blue sky and in nature and enjoying their environment. But life could be pretty harsh for those kids, too.
That's right. Nature was dangerous, too. And if it was cold and the corn needed picking, they would be out there with their hands getting chapped from the cold. They were exposed to tornadoes. They were exposed to prairie fires. It was not just the nice side of nature, the blue sky and the butterflies, that they experienced. They also experienced nature in the raw, which could be pretty unpleasant.
They also needed to have an understanding of nature. I mean, we think about how much more sophisticated science is today, but farm kids in that day had a basic understanding of biology that a lot of kids today don't have.
That's right. And that was very important. They had to understand about planting and about watching things grow. They understood a whole lot about animal biology as well. We tend to think of them as being somehow sheltered, but they were not sheltered at all from, the basic biology of life and death.
It's interesting to me to explore the idea of the dangers of nature. You wrote about a boy who was working on planting his family's garden, and it was full of rattlesnakes, and he kept calling his dad over to kill the rattlesnakes. And finally, his dad said, you know, if I were 10 years old, I wouldn't be calling somebody else to kill all these rattlesnakes. And so then the boy took over the job. So that kind of demonstrates not just the dangers, but also this idea of nature as something that had to be tamed. Was that a general idea that these kids grew up with?
Certainly. I mean, if there were snakes in your path, you got rid of them. If there were weeds in the garden, you pulled them. If there were bugs on the potato plants, you squashed them. There were nice elements of nature, but there were also elements of nature that endangered your ability to make a living and your family's ability to eat. And you exercised as much control over those as you could. But then you also realize that there were elements of the natural world that could not be controlled, like the hailstorm or the grasshoppers. And you learned very, very quickly that you really relied on nature. And if nature at that moment was going to be unkind, your family might be in seriously straitened conditions in the next winter.
A lot of our great conservationists were born during that time, came of age during that time, and obviously developed a great deal of love and respect for nature. But we also, looking back at that time, we can't idealize it too much. I mean, this was the period of time during which many animals that were native to the United States and native to Iowa were hunted to the brink of extinction. And this was the time when the tall grass prairie almost disappeared because it was entirely plowed under. I mean, this was a time when man really came to dominate nature in the Midwest.
And it was dominated basically in the service of feeding people, building farms, raising crops, making sure that families, you know, one's own family and other families were fed.
I'm curious about this aspect of it because I've done some research in my life about how people respond to animals. And one of the things that if you, for example, you take a dog into a nursing home, it can be a very therapeutic experience for a resident. Usually their blood pressure goes down and they enjoy this interaction. For people who worked with animals, many farmers, veterinarians, et cetera, they actually can have the opposite response to that interaction because it reminds them of something that was stressful in their life, their work. And so I want to explore this a little bit more because I wonder what kind of nature ethic came out of that life? I mean, again, we think about the idyllic parts, but it was a very hard life. And these grown-ups knew it. These kids knew it. Do you think that the ethic of dominating nature also grew out of that danger and that hard life?
I think that it could go any number of ways. On the one hand, people could come to feel very adversarial things about nature and feel a real need to dominate that environment. But there were also people who came away from that experience feeling a real kinship to nature. And I think it just depended on the individual, which direction their feelings went. Many people also responded to growing up in this environment simply with a desire to leave farms behind and move to town and only visit nature when they really felt like it.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about life in town during the same period. And you write about towns in the Midwest. You also write about big cities like New York City. But let's save that for a little while later. Let's talk about these towns, the town kids in the Midwest during this time period from 1865 to, say, 1910 or 1915 or so. What was their relationship with the outdoor world like?
Their relationship with the outdoor world was, in a lot of ways, very much like that of farm children. They might not be exposed to the extremes of nature that farm children were, but they spent a lot of time outside. They would escape into the outdoors as often as they could. I read stories that elderly Iowans had written about their experiences, and there are all these adventures that they take, where on a summer afternoon, everybody, you know, grabs a few cookies and heads down the road to go find an adventure in the farmer's fields at the edge of town, or in the woods at the edge of town, or the river at the edge of town. And they had a very intimate relationship with the nature that they went out to find. And they also had a very intimate relationship with their towns. Children weren't confined to the house and to the school. They wandered all over the place. They rode their bicycles all over the place. There was practically no place that they didn't go. And so it was not at all unusual to see children in practically every place in town.
And, of course, there were those wild patches that were left within towns or close to towns, right?
There were. Sometimes it didn't even have to be a big patch. You know, there were vacant lots, and kids loved vacant lots. And even if they were a little bit developed, you know, some concrete here, some walls there, it didn't seem to matter a whole lot. Whatever space was available, they made their own.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Pamela Riney Kerberg. She is a professor of history, also the chair of the history department at Iowa State University. And her latest book is called The Nature of Childhood, an environmental history of growing up in America since 1865. You're also welcome to join our conversation as the hour goes on. Share your memories of playing outdoors as a child. What have you done to allow your kids to roam free in today's world, or maybe why you've chosen not to? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, on Earth Day, we're talking about childhood and how it has changed, really over decades and decades, how childhood has moved from outdoors to indoors. With me today is Pamela Riney Kerberg. She is the author of the new book, The Nature of Childhood, an environmental history of growing up in America since 1865. And you are welcome to join our conversation this hour. Do you have a special place that you remember playing when you were a child, an outdoor place? What did you learn there? Tell us about your adventures and what it meant to you. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Pam, just before the break, we were talking about the relationship that town kids had with nature. And in some, this again, at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, in some ways, those kids were kind of in the sweet spot. They didn't have as many responsibilities as the kids out in the country, but they still had a lot of freedom and a lot of access.
Yes, they did. And the accounts that I've read, particularly of elder Iowans about their experiences in small towns all across the state, makes it sound like a really enchanting sort of place. But at the same time, one of the things that I love about some of their accounts is they also talk about how the world smelled And I don't think we often realize just how different the world smells today than it did for them. And so one of the women wrote about her walk through town and everything she could smell as she walked through it. Everything from, you know, the lovely smell at the grocery store to the not so nice smells of manure piles. And it was a very different world.
And not quite as varnished and whitewashed. You mentioned a girl talking about what she smelled and what she experienced. What was the difference between the kind of freedom that girls at this time had and boys at this time had?
I think parents tended to be a little more careful with their girls, perhaps a few more rules about where they could go and what they could do. Also, girls tended to have a little bit less free time than boys did because no matter what the season, there was always work to be done indoors. And so mom could always find something for a daughter to do, whereas the boys were sometimes underfoot. But I do find lots of accounts of girls having practically as much freedom as their brothers to go exploring and to really get to know their worlds.
Now let's shift to cities. And of course, the Midwest at that time didn't have a lot of big cities, Chicago, of course, St. Louis. But you write quite a bit about New York City and how children were able to run free in an urban environment for a long time. But of course, that was filled with dangers.
Children got the opportunity to run outdoors and, in fact, were encouraged to do so because families often lived in such tiny spaces. You could have, you know, 8-10 people living in a single room or maybe two rooms, and families just did not have the space for children. And on top of that, that particular space was often not terribly attractive to a child. There was nothing to do in there. It was often hot, uncomfortable, and it was much more fun to go outside. And they roamed the streets. They played in the streets. They swam in the river. They did anything they wanted to in that environment out of doors, but with the knowledge that all the adults' eyes were on them. The parents might be indoors, but there were windows. And if you did something wrong, if you misbehaved, your parents would find out. And there was that sort of control on the situation. Also, if there was someone out there who perhaps wasn't terribly kind to children, was behaving badly toward them, other adults would see and would take care of the situation.
But still, in these cities, obviously, there was a great deal more traffic. Children played in the streets. You have a photo in the book of a boy who lost his leg to a trolley car. The dangers in the city strike me as just much more present and real than the dangers in the country.
Well, they were different sorts of dangers. You know, in the countryside, there were serious dangers from horses and other animals. In the countryside or in the city, you were dodging traffic. And I think the single most important cause of or non-illness cause of death for children in places like New York City, say in 1910, 1920, was automobile traffic. It was dangerous. And the kids incorporated that danger right on into their play. I think in some ways they felt like they were in a contest with the adult users of the street to see who was going to get to use that space and who was going to prevail.
And in the cities, it was those dangers that got kids banned from the street and really started a shift in the amount of freedom that children had.
Right. A number of municipalities began passing laws saying that you were not allowed, if you were below a certain age, to loiter, and you weren't allowed to play games in the street. And particularly, they legislated against street baseball. And that tended to upset children greatly because they often had no other place to play baseball.
And the result of that, very slowly, was that parks did become places for children, right?
Right. Parks, initially as they were imagined, were not supposed to be play spaces for kids. And caretakers would basically shoo the children out and evict them. They began to change the rules about parks and allow kids to play there. There's also what's called a playground movement, and there's the creation of playgrounds. Of course, a lot of them are not spaces that we would look at and think were good for children to play in. There's a lot of concrete, a lot of asphalt, a lot of really dangerous looking playground equipment. I don't know if you've ever seen photographs of 19th and early 20th century jungle gyms, but they are very high and they are over concrete.
Well, and I remember even from my childhood, the jungle gym on our playground at school was quite high, maybe not as high as some of the ones in the pictures in your book, but it was over concrete. So that's something that lasted for quite a while. We're going to talk more in just a moment about some of the changes that really took place in the mid part of the 20th century, a lot of the changes that affected us when we were children, and also the beginnings of environmental education for kids. But I also want to include some people in this conversation who would like to weigh in on this topic. You can give us a call if you'd like to tell us about a place where you played when you were a child, share some of your memories, or talk about the decisions you've made with your kids today. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jonathan is on the line from Clive. Hello, Jonathan.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for calling. And what does this topic make you think about?
Well, of course, it makes me think about growing up, but first, in my 70s here, it makes me add to my collection of writings memories of growing up so I can write it down for my grandchildren. And I think it's a great thing to be able to do. But when I grew up in Arlington, Virginia. And yes, it's a residential area, but we had the opportunity to wander around as much as going to the movies on Saturday morning, taking a 3-mile walk to get there. And then by the time we were in the sixth grade and riding bicycles, we could get down along the Potomac River through the George Washington Parkway that was not completed, and we would have to walk down the banks. And as kids, we discovered the outlines, the foundations of what must have been about 10 by 12 foot forts that were used during the Civil War. So, of course, our imaginations ran rampant being able to walk through this. And I can remember riding bicycle much, much further to see the parts of the Iwo Jima Memorial as they lay on the ground. And, of course, in those days, nothing had fences around it. So we were able to do whatever we wanted. At one point, we had a park with summer activities for kids, which always included a great fun thing, which was at twilight, they would show movies sponsored by the Washington Post newspaper. And, of course, every Friday night it began with the Washington Post March. But I think of my childhood as being able to get out and do whatever I wanted. We had woods behind our apartment. We had a creek where one learned real quickly that nettles were not the thing you wanted to mess with, that it had crayfish in it, so it couldn't have been too polluted. And the creek eventually ran into a tunnel, which we were terrified to go in, but we did as far as we could see. But very, very different than what my children or grandchildren are growing up in.
Do you feel like your grandkids are missing something because they don't get to do that stuff?
Probably not so much because in Clive, for instance, we have the Green Belt, and it's available to everybody. But those of us that live close to us can walk, and we're in the woods immediately. And, of course, playgrounds at school are very different than they used to be, much more gentle on the body. So I'm not so sure that they have missed so much, particularly with a grandfather that's always taking them out to things like the wildlife refuges and parks and other things.
Well, good job, Jonathan. Thank you so much for your call. And, you know, Pamela, as things changed, we think a lot about the dangers that kids did encounter out there in cities, in the country. And that's a subject that we got an email on. And this is from Deb. She says, I remember the day that letting your child play outside died. September 1982, when Johnny Gosch was taken during his paper route in Des Moines. It all changed for children and parents when we had to fear that someone would take them. My first child was 6 weeks old. And, of course, anybody who grew up in Iowa remembers when that happened, when Johnny Gosch disappeared. But anybody who grew up anywhere probably remembers one moment like that, where there was a story about a child getting hurt, a child getting taken, that changed how they felt about the world. And that fear really changed a lot about the kinds of freedoms that kids had. Pamela, when you look at how things changed, was a lot of it in reaction to fear?
A lot of it is in reaction to fear. There's some very, very well publicized cases that happened in the late 70s, early 1980s, Johnny Gosch in Des Moines, of course, that are highly publicized. And people become very, very aware in ways that in a previous generation they wouldn't have been. And I think there's a number of things that are all coming together at once. One is awareness, which just had not been so great previously. And, of course, one part of that awareness is the milk carton campaigns, right, where pictures of missing children are put on milk cartons. That starts here in Iowa with the Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin cases. But it's not just the awareness. It is, at the same time, a number of changes going on in entertainment technology and the technology of homes that make households, the interior of households, much more appealing to children. And so you have fear and technology coming together at the same time in a way that really fosters an indoor childhood.
Well, and you mentioned earlier that kids went outside to play because the parents were busy. They had a lot of work to do. I think that the interaction between technology and kids is in some ways a response to the same thing. Parents are busy. We have a lot of work to do. And sometimes it's harder to get your child to go outside and play, or you get interrupted more often, or you have to worry about them more than if they're in the other room watching television.
That's right. And all of this also happens about the same time as we get MTV. A lot of proliferation of cable TV, VCRs, a lot of video games, and the number of ways that children could be entertained indoors mushrooms in the late 1970s and early 1980s. When I was young, television wasn't that exciting because I think we had three channels, and a lot of the time they didn't come in terribly well, and it just wasn't that interesting. And, you know, a generation later, and the possibilities have multiplied.
There's something to watch always.
Always.
Let's go back to the phone. Summer is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Summer.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I grew up in Southeast Missouri, although I was born in Des Moines. And we had on our street, it cul-de-sacked into a park and a creek and basically a wooded area. And a lot of my childhood with my sibling and then my neighbor kids, we would go down to the creek and play in the creek. We would catch tadpoles and crawdads. We would, you know, go down to as far down the creek as we, you know, felt brave enough to go and play hide and seek in the woods and have picnics on the rocks on the creek. So that was basically my childhood.
What do you think you learned from those experiences?
I was able to learn how to be brave, you know, going further down the creek the next day than I did, you know, the day before. Very, very much of a sense of adventure and imagination, because we played. I mean, that was our, I guess, theater or arena that we imagined different scenarios in.
Well, Summer, thank you so much for your call.
Yes, no problem. Have a wonderful day.
You too. And Pam, we think about those wonderful outdoor adventures that so many of us had as kids. At the same time, there was a big push in the really 40s, 50s, and 60s for environmental awareness among kids. And I know that some of the groups started even earlier than that. But can you characterize that movement?
There was a real concern that children have an educated understanding of nature. And so you get the creation of groups, the creation of curriculum for grade schools and for middle schools and high schools. You also get organizations that you wouldn't necessarily think of as promoting nature education beginning to do so. 4-H, for example, is really involved in nature education. But there's also the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, Campfire, all sorts of organizations out there that are trying to get children into nature and educate children about nature and to get them to think in the right way about nature, that nature is your friend, that you're supposed to treat it well, you're supposed to treat animals well, you're supposed to, you know, not leave even your footprints behind. There's a real concentration on outdoor education for kids.
And we'll talk more about that in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. I'm talking with Pamela Riney-Kerberg. She is the author of the new book, The Nature of Childhood, An Environmental History of Growing Up in America Since 1865. She's also a professor and chair of the history department at Iowa State University. And you're welcome to join our conversation with your memories and your thoughts at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today on Earth Day, we're talking about how childhood in the United States has changed from way back in 1865 to today. I'm talking with Pamela Riney-Kerberg. She is the author of the new book, The Nature of Childhood, An Environmental History of Growing Up in America Since 1865. You're welcome to join the conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Pam, just before the break, we were talking about environmental education and how that really blossomed in the mid part of the 20th century and, of course, continues to grow today. But I think about some of the things that I used to see and hear when I was a kid. We think about Smokey Bear, Give a Hoot, Don't Pollute, so many different messages that were coming at us, telling us to be good stewards of the earth, even if we weren't necessarily seeing that in other places.
Right. These were a really important set of educational campaigns in the middle of the 20th century. And, you know, Give a Hoot, Don't Pollute with Woodsy Owl was all over the place when I was a kid. In fact, I remember parts of the Woodsy Owl song. Woodsy Owl still exists, but not in the same active form as he did in the 1970s.
Sometimes I wonder, as we had this shift away from kids just playing outside and being outside and getting dirty and exploring and finding salamanders and frogs and doing that kind of stuff on their own, to the scouts and other groups where there is this sort of structured engagement with the environment. And we do see a lot of that today. Do you ever worry that we've taken some of the fun out of being in nature?
That's what seems to be one of the biggest problems to me, is that kids look outside and can't see what's supposed to be fun about it if they are constantly being told what to do by someone else or where they can go. All you have to do is watch a playground and the kind of structured activity that happens there, and after a while begin to wonder, what's fun about this? Especially if you follow the rules. And if you go to most playgrounds today, you'll notice there are sets of rules posted that tell you what you're supposed to do, what you're not supposed to do. And, you know, if you spend all your time following the rules, that also takes a lot of the fun out of it.
Right. Well, you put a picture in your book of a playground where I've played many times in Ames, Iowa. It's a lovely playground, and it's surrounded by woods. There's a ravine nearby. And you point out that you see a lot of kids on that playground, but you don't see them exploring the woods behind the playground.
That's right. I see a lot of parents sitting there making sure that they stay within the rectangle that is defined by the railroad ties and surrounds the play area. I have lived across the street from this wonderful park for 14 years. And in the course of those 14 years, I have, and it also, it backs up on the Skunk River, which has a lovely walking trail beside it. And I have seen precisely one child playing unsupervised in the Skunk River in 14 years. And, you know, that may not seem surprising to a lot of people, but growing up, I just can't imagine my own, if I had had my childhood next to that river, that I wouldn't have been in it on a fairly regular basis. It bothers me that that kind of unstructured, free-flowing, imaginative fun doesn't seem to be possible.
Let's go back to the phones. Pam is on the line in Newton. Hi, Pam.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your story?
Well, I grew up in Chicago, right in the city, not a suburb, and we were fortunate enough to have the Chicago Park District, which ran and organized playgrounds throughout the city. And Kedville Park was the one I used to go to, which was about a half a block away. There were swings and slides, and it was a big, open, kind of paved area with a field house. And in the summertime, you could go there and play, and they had a lady in the field house that would teach you how to do crafts. And then in the wintertime, they would take up all the swings, and they would freeze the entire playground for ice skating. And I remember going there, and there was always a wood-burning stove inside the field house where you could go warm up. The park district also provided a Halloween party where we would all get dressed up and go over there, and they would have games and everything for all of us. And it was just a wonderful area, lots of things to do. And this was in the late 50s and 60s, and one of the things I'd like to mention is it's just a coincidence that I have found on Facebook a group called I Grew Up by Jimmy's Hot Dogs. And there are about, 200 of us that grew up in the neighborhood that are now part of this Facebook group. And so everybody is giving their ideas of what went on at the time, pictures posted of the old homes that we used to live in. And so it's just a real coincidence, but it was a good place to grow up.
And it sounds like you had a lot of independence and a lot of freedom.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, my mother would, she was a house homemaker, and I would be down, our whole block was full of kids, and we would be at one another's houses. We would be playing on the porch all day with our dolls, you know, and she'd just yell out the window to come home for dinner.
Well, Pam, thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome.
And Pam, the other Pam, you write quite a lot about how children don't have the kind of independence that they had. And of course, there are real dangers that parents are responding to in not allowing their children to roam free. I mean, I'm a mother of two kids, and of course, I see every news story that comes about of a child who gets injured or disappears or something like that. And of course, it creates fear in parents. But you also point out that the world has actually become safer since all of us were roaming the neighborhoods in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, the number of crimes against children, I mean, abductions and child murders, is actually no higher than it was when we were children. And I think that's perhaps reflective of better mental health care and things like that over the last 20 to 30 years. But also, I think that we don't recognize or don't want to think about some of the real dangers involved in things that we allow our children to do, you know, without consideration. Swimming pools actually pose a greater danger than stranger abduction. Our automobiles pose a far greater danger than something like stranger abduction. But we send our kids to the pool and we drag them around in our cars. all the time without thinking about how great that danger is.
There is a movement today among many parents, among many educators, among many people trying to get children back outdoors. How do you feel about the No Child Left Inside movement that we've talked about on this program? And people write blogs about there. There really are a lot of people who, of course, are trying to reverse what they see as the damage of keeping kids inside too much.
I think it's a really interesting idea. I don't think there's anything to be lost in sending children outside to play more regularly than we do now. But a lot of people want to send kids outside to play, but also maintain all of the safety they can imagine. And I think that's where you run into resistance from the children. Children, if they're going to be sent outside to play, don't want to be told exactly how to do it by somebody else. And it's a difficult balancing act, getting them outside and getting them outside and able to be independent enough to have a good time doing it.
Marilee is on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Marilee.
Hi.
What would you like to talk about?
You know, I am in a position of being a grandmother, and I remember very fondly spending hours and hours of unstructured time out and about my neighborhood growing up in Cedar Rapids, which even then was, you know, enough of a city. But at the end of my block was what we would call a crick, not a creek, definitely a crick. And we'd catch crawdaddies and play down there and swing on the willow tree. Those creeks in town have been paved over now and aren't even available. I see my grandkids going from structured play to structured play to structured activity to lesson, play dates, et cetera. And I wonder about what they lose by having so much structure.
Have you done anything with your grandkids to try to recreate the kind of experiences that you had when you were a kid?
Yeah, my whole family thinks I'm a little odd, but I spend some time every day trying to get out and hike. I did not grow up that way. Now in midlife, I've discovered the wonders of the state and national parks around, or state parks around, and try to get that to them on a regular basis. And I've taken the grandkids with me. Here in Iowa, I think one of our great gems would be Palisades Kepler State Park, where you can have a variety of different terrains to trudge through. And I've been able to take my oldest grandchild there, even though his mother's a little nervous about us climbing around on rocks and by the river. But to be able to get out and see eagles, to look at fossils in the rocks, and just have fun wandering, I think is something
very
priceless. And does
it work?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I haven't gotten to do it that often, but I think what it has done has created some just incomparable memories for both me and the kids.
Marilee, thank you so much for your call.
Yes, thank you. Let's all celebrate Earth Day and get outside today.
Marilee, thanks a lot. And Pam, in your research, I'm curious, you talked about how, you know, there will be this beautiful playground surrounded by nature and the kids don't go into nature. Do kids know what to do when they go outside and have unstructured play, or have we sort of trained it out of them?
Well, that's a good question. I am happy to say that one of my friends regularly posts on Facebook pictures of her daughter up a tree. So not everybody has forgotten. But I've also read stories, you know, mothers writing about their kids going out and spending an hour outside, coming back in, and the next day, you know, asking the children if they want to go back out again. Oh, no, we've done that already. They sometimes don't understand that the world out there changes every day and there's always something new to be seen.
But on the same page, I mean, there are a lot of kids who have found that joy, I think, as well. And they do have amazing imaginations. Barry is on the line now from Marion. Hi, Barry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I grew up in the 1950s in two small Midwestern towns, had a lot of unstructured time. I didn't really think about it at the time, but one of the greatest benefits, I think, was we learned how to mediate our own disputes. We learned how to compromise to get things done. And I, in critiquing my own parenting days, my kids are in around 30 years old now, and I think I had a tendency to kind of hover, help them come to conclusions on disputes, and looking back, I probably should have backed off a little more. And I think maybe that's happening today, you know, with more and more inside time, more and more structure of activities. Kids aren't getting a chance to compromise, learn the compromise skills, and so on.
All right. Barry, thank you so much.
You bet.
And I guess, Pam, we're not just talking about nature. We are talking about independence as well.
Right. Independence, imagination, just having an opportunity to be on your own without all the clutter and noise that goes with modern life. I really appreciated that as a child. And I wish that everybody had the opportunity just to be free of the clutter and noise and enjoy their surroundings without constantly having the world intrude on them.
Let's take one more call. This is Dick in Dubuque. Hi, Dick.
Hi. Yeah, just growing up in the 50s, of course, Dubuque's got the bluffs. We had the caves, building camps, building forts, the river, of course, riding miles to fish and swim. But the other thing, you know, to make the connection with literature, poetry like Hiawatha and Fenimore Cooper stuff, you know, either the films or the literature, you know, you felt it. You know, you felt maybe the same call that, you know, our ancestors had or Native Americans had, but you could feel the literature and experience yourself and your imagination.
Yeah, Dick, thank you so much for your call. And I know, Pam, that was one of the things that resonates with you, too, pretending that you were playing on the banks of Plum Creek when you were down by that canal.
Oh, yes. Laura Ingalls Wilder was my constant companion.
Now, I know that one of your great sadnesses is that your son can't really enjoy completely unstructured, unsupervised play outside because he is autistic. And that's a frustration for you. But in your research and as you look around the world, how do you feel about the future? Do you feel like there is motion in the right direction?
This is one of those areas where I'm just not quite sure. I think we're just going to have to wait and see. One of the things that being a historian tells me is that children learn to make the best of where they are, that adults are often very insecure, very unhappy, very unsure about environments that they're in. But children, looking at it through their own inexperienced eyes, learn to make the best of where they are. And I'm always positive about the ability of children to innovate and to learn to make the best of things.
Well, I'll leave the conversation today with this final email from Dan. He said, I had a great childhood experience. I grew up only a block from the Fox River in northern Illinois, and my backyard was a private park of about 200 acres owned by a fraternal organization. All of us had access to the park and river where we played and fished every day. As I got older, my parents allowed me to ride my bike into town, which was about 5 miles away. We never worried about where we were and what we did. All our neighbors looked out for us and reported inappropriate behavior in addition to handling it themselves. Dan obviously remembers a very different time. Pamela, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And happy Earth Day. Pamela Riney-Kerberg is the author of The Nature of Childhood, an environmental history of growing up in America since 1865. With me in the studio now is Ben Kiefer, River to River, coming up today at noon. What do you have planned, Ben?
Hi, Charity. We have sort of an educational theme with our two shows today. We'll be looking at, during the noon hour, something called the Big Ideas Group. It exists in Cedar Rapids, and it's an alternative way to approach education. And I guess that's all I'll say about it now. Just tune in at noon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ben. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, the 25th anniversary of the Field of Dreams.